This episode is made possible by Awin. Two-thirds of digital ad spend currently flows to the three big tech platforms, Google, Meta, and Amazon. But their auction-based ad models favor their own bottom line and inflate costs at a time when every single marketing dollar counts. Awin's affiliate partnerships platform offers a real alternative to big tech and puts you back in control of your ad spend. Want to find out how? Visit awin.com/emarketer to learn more. Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers weekly listen and e-marketer podcast made possible by Awin. This is the Friday show that is rocking a Fila sweatshirt. Very nice, Blake. I'm expecting you to have your podcast notes written on an Etch-a-Sketch, of course.
Wow.
Going all 90s. Blake said, could we finish this episode on time because he has to go and feed his Tamagotchi, which I get. They're hard to keep alive. Did anyone keep them alive for longer than 24 hours? The answer
I had a Gigapet, so slightly different than a Tamagotchi.
Oh.
It was more of a Pogs guy.
Now we're talking. Very nice. Very nice.
The Gigapet did not last long, though, either.
No. This is going to be a good show, I can tell. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson. In today's show, Amazon searching for its next big hit.
The idea that they're going to be able to come in and be a disruptor to the point that it has done in the past with these other pillar industries, it's very unlikely.
Will X/Twitter become a subscription-only platform?
Less than a fifth of U.S. population uses Twitter. In other countries, the penetration rate is even lower. And that's including the inflated numbers that they have from bots. So you're going to ask these people then to pay for the service. A lot of these people don't even use it that much to begin with.
Is SEO dead?
When dealing with AI, search engines is about creating content that answers more complicated questions. I think that's the only way you're really going to be able to win like a position in the AI-derived search results.
Are free returns a goner? And what is the shortest commercial flight that you can take? Join me for this episode. We have three people. Let's meet them. We start with our director of reports editing based in the northern part of New York. It's Rahul Chadha.
Hey, nice to be here.
Hello there. We're also joined by one of our senior analysts on the retail and e-commerce team based in New York City. It's Blake Droesch.
Hey, everybody.
And finally, we have one of our senior analysts on the digital advertising and media team. He's just above the city and his name is Ross Benish.
Howdy.
Hello. So, folks, we have a story of the week for you. We're talking about Amazon's next big hit. Then we'll go to the debate of the week, where our panelists will try to present the best for and against arguments from three different stories we have for you. And then finally, we'll talk about some random trivia in dinner party data. But we start, of course, with the story of the week. Amazon searches for its next big hit. The tech giant has built three wildly successful businesses. It's been toiling for years to find a fourth pillar, writes Sebastian Herrera and Nate Ratner of the Wall Street Journal. They explain that the first three pillars, each bringing in tens of billions of dollars in annual revenue, are its online shopping marketplace, number one, Prime membership program, number two, and cloud computing unit, number three, it's AWS. Together, those three units account for close to 90% of Amazon's sales. But there have been many attempts to try to find a fourth pillar for the company, a fourth major revenue stream. And those have included healthcare investments, things like buying pharmacy startup PillPack. They were working on telehealth service called Amazon Care. That's now been shut down. They bought a host of primary care practices called One Medical. So a bunch of things in healthcare. In-store shopping experiments. They bought Whole Foods, $14 billion 6 years ago. They closed some bookstores and four-star locations. So some things there. And then also entertainment and hardware efforts. They've been trying to dominate the smart home with the Amazon Echo devices. They sunset their home security drone, a home robot, smart health ring. But some investors are starting to lose patience, the article notes. So, gents, why do you think Amazon hasn't been able to find a fourth hit, if you will?
You know, when you list all of the initiatives that Amazon has launched over the past however many years, it feels quite a lot like they're trying to boil the ocean. You know, I think it's possible you can spread your efforts too thin, even if you are Amazon. I mean, I think you could make the argument that their advertising business is already is a fourth pillar. You know, I think, well, I'm guessing its share of its total revenues is relatively small compared to probably like their revenues from their marketplace or Amazon Web Services. The profit margins for the digital advertising business are pretty staggering, I think, comparatively speaking. You know, the marginal cost of digital ads is like pretty minimal, I think, compared to a lot of their business units.
Well, when I wrote this question, that was exactly what came to mind. I was like, wait, isn't advertising already a fourth pillar? Because they make more money from advertising than they do from Prime memberships. And that's now, in terms of it being influential, Prime memberships is obviously really, really important. But that's one thing. They make more money from advertising already. And then the second thing here, in 2 years' time, they'll be approaching Meta's share of US digital ad revenue. Meta's share. So there's 18% share of the digital ad pie in the US for Meta, 15, just 3 points less for Amazon in 2 years' time. 2 years ago, it was half the size. Put another way, Meta obviously is Facebook and Instagram and others, but mainly those two. Amazon already makes more money from ads than Facebook. So it feels like that is a fourth pillar, no?
Yeah, I think, you know, just to take one step backwards, Amazon was really able to become dominant in its e-commerce marketplace because of the fact that it was developed at the time when e-commerce itself was maturing rapidly. And I think it's now trying to approach markets that are already established. But I do think that media and advertising together will be that fourth pillar because of what it's doing on the media side. There still is some maturity, particularly in sports and digital transformation, which it's already making inroads on. And it's more about building its media and advertising on top of its existing e-commerce platform, which all connects into the greater flywheel. So it's not necessarily about building pillars anymore, I think, for Amazon. It's about adding new offerings that go on top of its current pillars that are going to continue to perpetuate the flywheel. So I think it's just really looking at its business development differently than a lot of analysts had when it was really building and evolving in these sort of rapidly maturing industries.
Now, I was just going to add to what everyone else has said. When you proposed this question, I agreed that Amazon already has another pillar in advertising. Some of these businesses that the article lists are complementary to each other or almost the same thing. So when you talk about Amazon's entertainment and streaming ambitions, that goes into advertising. And our forecast that has them growing at such a high rate, well, they'll eventually eclipse Meta, that was done before Amazon announced that they're forcing ads into Prime Video. And they're making advertising the default, which is terrible for users, but will be great for their ad business. There's going to be a lot of people who are going to find ads one day and not realize why that came to be because they've had an ad-free experience for so long. But when Amazon starts pushing heavily into this next year, they're going to be one of the big streaming advertising companies. When you have Fire TV and Freevee and their DSP, and now you have Prime Video ads and the stuff they're doing with sports, not to mention all the search advertising they have as a retail media network, they're going to be a juggernaut. It's really a true triopoly, and they'll probably actually be the number two company before long in the US.
Right. So it seems like there either is a fourth pillar, if you want to separate it out, or you could say, forget the fourth pillar. Because advertising, like you were saying, is built on top of e-commerce and media. And so it's just enhancing or strengthening that third pillar. Maybe they should just focus on those three and not so much on all these other experiments. I only listed some of them. There's a lot of others that haven't gone particularly well for the company. I wanted quickly, gents, your take on this last piece of news. So Amazon, Rachel Wolf, who writes for our retail briefing, was noting Amazon could launch a standalone grocery and healthcare subscriptions as well, and also explore adding primary care services via One Medical, which they bought, to the existing suite of Prime benefits. So it'd be enhancing that Prime pillar. Rachel was saying that with Prime growth slowing, Amazon faces a choice between adding more features, which could require it to raise fees, and launching a standalone memberships that offer consumers more entry points to its service, but risk diluting the Prime brand and its overall value proposition. What do we think about the direction of Prime? Should they just enhance it by adding some of these things or have them as kind of standalone entities?
Well, I think when you look at grocery and healthcare, this is a perfect example of two industries that are already super established. And if Amazon wants to carve out a slice of these industries, particularly, you know, with grocery, within the digital grocery niche, then like, yes, it's still an area worth investing for them. But the idea that they're going to be able to come in and be a disruptor to the point that it has done in the past with these other pillar industries, it's very unlikely. I think, you know, in terms of just for grocery alone, if Amazon wants to ever seriously compete with Walmart and all the other brick and mortar grocers, I mean, it's going to have to invest billions of dollars into opening new stores, or else it's just never going to be able to compete. So there's a difference between what could potentially be a growth vehicle for Amazon, like increasing, you know, food and beverage and household goods sales on the website, versus like actually becoming a formidable disruptor in a very, very large and established industry.
All right, well, that's where we leave it for today with regards to the story of the week. Let's move to the debate of the week. Today's segment, make the case. Our panel, Rahul, Ross, and Blake, present the for and against arguments for each of the following questions based on three news stories. Two contestants face off per question. The following takes don't necessarily reflect the analyst's personal views, except Blake. He believes everything he says and will defend it to the death. He's a tough colleague to be around, to be honest. I'm kidding, of course. The panel's job is to just present the best case regardless and offer objective analysis. We start with question one. Rahul, going up against Ross, we're talking about Musk suggesting X, or Twitter, might become a subscription-only platform. Our briefing's writer, Daniel Konstantinovich, notes that X/Twitter owner Elon Musk said that the platform is moving toward a subscription-only model, calling it, quote, the only way I can think of to combat vast armies of bots, close quote. Question here is, should X/Twitter become a subscription-only platform? Rahul is going to go first. So Rahul, it does make sense for X/Twitter to become a subscription-only platform. 1 minute on the clock, courtesy of V, who edits the show. Make the case.
I mean, I don't think they'll have any other option. Like, watching their advertising efforts is kind of like watching a clown car being set aflame and then driven off a cliff. You know, I think Musk himself admitted that the company's ad revenues are down 60%. The Times has reported that it's missing its weekly sales target, that ad sales staff are troubled by a rise in hate speech on the platform. We've got Musk picking fights with entities like the Anti-Defamation League. You know, I think brands are running away from the platform's toxicity and ineptitude. It's like, you know, we think of brand safety as like advertisers not wanting their content to be shown around toxic content. But what if the platform itself is toxic? And, you know, when it comes to subscriptions, I don't know how else they're going to make money.
Ross, it doesn't make sense for X or
Twitter. I just want to, before I get into that, well, Rahul said it was a clown car driving off a cliff. What if the cliff, though, was a, like, you know, there was water under that cliff? Would that extinguish the fire of the clown car? You know, it could be counteracting disaster there.
Are you going to make me think through my metaphor? Like, I'm not even sure who the clowns are. Are those the advertisers?
The car would be sinking pretty fast.
I mean, everybody in the car is going to die, right? So,
okay. Yeah. Let me go establish that. Just thought the cliff might help the fire.
Ross is like, I need more context. Okay.
I mean, if it's hard ground under that cliff, then I get what you're saying. But if you're, what if it's just a river, you know?
I mean, you know, if the flames don't kill you, the fall will, right?
Yeah. Depends on the cliff, but yeah.
Metaphor got too technical.
So anyways, yes. I can start my thing.
It doesn't make sense, is what you're arguing, for Twitter to become a subscription-only platform. Make the case.
Well, most people don't use Twitter or don't like Twitter. The media class, they are outliers in the U.S. population. Less than a fifth of the U.S. population uses Twitter. In other countries, the penetration rate is even lower. And that's including the inflated numbers that they have from bots. So you're going to ask these people then to pay for the service. A lot of these people don't even use it that much to begin with. There's just a lot better ways to spend your money. I'm sure the people in the press would pay for it because they seem to have nothing better to do with their time than to waste time, you know, bitching at each other on Twitter. But most people are not going to pay for Twitter. Like, it's just going to be a small pool of people who are interested in that product.
Well, so there was that survey from digital marketing services company iTech that Daniel pointed to, 9 out of 10 folks not willing to pay for an X subscription. If they had no other choice, maybe some would let up. But right now, pretty much everyone's saying absolutely not. But yeah, to Rahul's point about ad revenue going off this metaphorical cliff with who knows what at the bottom. It's US ad revenue down 60%, according to Musk, as Rahul mentioned, our March revision estimating that Twitter's US ad revenues would fall nearly 30% this year, having fallen 3% last year. So the ad picture is looking bad.
Think about how much we talk about Twitter. Microsoft Bing makes more ad revenue than Twitter.
Yeah.
So like it's got to be one of, like, for the amount of revenue it generates and the amount of people that use it on a daily basis, it's got to be one of the most overblown products of our lifetime. I mean, it's kind of like how, and I'm guilty of this, it's kind of like how Succession got so much press, but was probably watched by like a few hundred thousand people. Like,
yeah,
you know, it's targeting the people who are, you know, most discussed in the news, celebrities and politicians and media members. But like, if you get outside of a city where most people are working in those industries, and you especially talk to people who don't have advanced degrees or maybe don't have college degrees, they are not on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah, every time I look at
that's millions and millions of people.
The share of digital ad pie that Twitter has, I always have a bit of cognitive dissonance because I'm like, these numbers can't be correct based on how much we talk about them. They're already about 0.8% share for Twitter. And with this, you know, negative 30% ad revenue growth in the US that we're forecasting, that takes them down to about 0.5%. And they definitely get way more of the conversation. It's definitely true. Let's move to our second question. We're going to have Rahul going up against Blake. And we're talking about SEO being dead. SEO is dead. Long live AO. If you're not optimizing for artificial intelligence algorithms, you're already behind, writes Don Reisinger of Inc. Mr. Reisinger has been using Google's AI-first search engine, which he admits is still in beta, and notes that it represents a major change in how search results are displayed. He explains that instead of simply showing results at the top of the page, Google AI search tries to answer your query, give you context, and let you ask follow-ups. The question here being, is algorithm optimization, AO, or search engine optimization, obviously SEO, more important at this point? Rahul, you're arguing that algorithm optimization, AO, is already more important than SEO, as Mr. Reisinger is trying to make that point, we think, in this article. 1 minute on the clock, make the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think as you mentioned it, by AO, we mean changing your SEO strategy to account for the changes wrought by AI. And this is a no-brainer, you know, Google's use of AI in terms of products they've already sort of modeled for the wider world result in content that's synthesized from several sources. But it does include links to the sources, so that gives marketers some chance to win click-through traffic. But, you know, I think the lesson for marketers is that you can't compete with the AI for easily answered questions. So I think the SEO strategy when dealing with AI search engines is about creating content that answers more complicated questions. I think that's the only way you're really going to be able to win like a position in the AI-derived search results.
Blake, SEO is still more important than AO, algorithm optimization. Make the case.
Yeah. I mean, who knows what the future is going to hold, but right now this, you know, Google AI search is still in beta. No one's using it and there's money to be made right now. So why wouldn't businesses still be focusing on SEO? Plus, once the mass adoption ramps up of AI search, the ball game is going to be completely different. There's going to be a whole set of sort of nebulous tools to try and figure out how to optimize your rankings and your search performance. So it's something that I think is still, you know, far off, and it can pay to obviously be forward thinking and be abreast of the new developments, but to completely, you know, throw any type of SEO optimization like and strategy into the trash can right now in favor of something that's probably still many years off in terms of consumer adoption seems like a big mistake to me.
Yeah, I mean, I would just add to that, like, I feel like even this, like, debate, I know for the purposes of the podcast, you have to create a pro and against, but, you know, I really do think this sounds more like an evolution. I think the fundamental principles of SEO are going to remain in place. You know, it's just about creating good content and that the, you know, Google algorithm considers to be a value. But, you know, I think, yeah, people who are interested in SEO are just going to have to evolve their strategies.
Ross, any thoughts here? Of course not, because he didn't read the article.
Yep.
Bloody hell, Ross. That's the kind of level of commitment you can expect from this podcast. Good arguments, gents. Let's move to question three, and we're going to have Blake going up against Ross. Are free returns a goner? H&M is the latest retailer joining Zara, Uniqlo, and others to move away from free online returns. Our Retail Briefings analyst Rachel Wolf explains that H&M will charge shoppers $2.50 a package after, I don't know why I had to confirm that, just in case you thought it was $250 a package, that's too much. It's just $2.50 a package. Maybe that's too expensive for some folks too. Although in-store returns will remain free and members of H&M's free loyalty program will get free returns from what I understand. But the question is, are we heading towards a world where most retailers don't offer free returns? Blake is going first. 1 minute on the clock to argue most retailers will offer free returns. Make the case.
Yeah, I think we're in a period where there's a little bit of a course correction where retailers, mainly following suit and trying to compete with Amazon, were offering free returns basically under any circumstances. And there was a lot of abuse of that policy. People were ordering, you know, doing this, like what is called color stacking, where they'll buy, you know, various colors and sizes of one product and then return everything that they didn't like and keep the one item. This was just creating a system and a culture around returns that was definitely cutting into the margins for a lot of retailers. But at the same time, you know, free returns is a very important part of the customer experience. And if your competitor is offering it and you're not, that can be really detrimental to you as a brand. So I think we're going to sort of see a little bit of a pullback where most retailers are going to offer free returns in some capacity. You might have to do a little bit of the legwork, as in, you know, bringing it back to a store or a drop-off location, but it is going to continue to be a competitive advantage for retailers who are offering it. So I think that there's still going to be an impetus for a lot of retailers to offer it.
Ross, most retailers won't offer free returns. Make the case.
Well, in general, there's been a push, especially for digitally focused companies, to show profit and not to just be focused on user retention or on user growth. So offering free returns cuts into those profits. And it just feels like most internet services are getting worse for consumers. They're cutting back perks that they originally offered so that you would get hooked on using the service. And I just feel like free returns are one of those things that was really nice to have, and it's going to be taken away from you soon.
Like subsidized ride-hailing services.
Yeah, exactly.
From investment companies. Yeah, no more of that. Or streaming services that were actually, in fact, cheaper than cable. Also gone. Yeah, we estimate that online returns volume will grow around 4% this year and each of the next few years. So that's going up. How do people return items? We estimate most folks, about 60 million odd, will use a courier or postal service, but that number is flat. Third-party drop-off is the only method that we see growing, currently at 45 million, getting closer to 50 by the end of our forecast in a number of years. All right, folks. Very nice. Very nice debate of the week. That's what we've got time for that segment. Let's move to our final one. It's dinner party data. This is the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing we've learned this week. And we start with Blake.
So student loan payments are going to resume at the beginning of October. So Civic Science ran a poll asking, if your student loan payments resume in October, have you reduced slash anticipate cutting spending on any of the following? Select all that apply. The number one activity was dining out. So expect potential, you know, restaurants to take a hit once the payments resume, followed by buying clothing, entertainment, sort of nebulous entertainment and travel. The activities and purchases that student loan payments are least likely to impact are buying gas, buying personal care items, and streaming services and subscriptions. So I guess holding on to the little delights of ad-supported streaming through our good friends at Amazon Prime is the one form of entertainment that's least likely to be affected.
Hmm. So they've already kicked in. They kick in soon.
October 1st.
Okay. And what have we baked into how much this is going to affect the retail space, Blake. We've mentioned that this is going to have somewhat of effects, but do you see it having like a small, medium, large size effect on the retail space when these kick back in?
Yeah, I mean, I think it potentially has a massive effect on the economy in general. I'm weary of giving any specific directive because, you know, I'm not an economist, but I think in terms of retail spending, yeah, it definitely could take a hit. I mean, you have so many people who have been, you know, who haven't had to repay their student loans, which many people have speculated has really kept retail sales strong over the last couple of months, even amidst, you know, this sort of period of inflation. And it could potentially be a really significant variable that starts to impact retail sales, you know, certainly at the beginning of next year, but potentially even hitting the holidays as well.
So, I mean, it definitely seems anecdotally when you talk to people who are going to have to pay back student loans, it's, you know, it's not a small amount. It's a good couple of hundred from a pretty decent paychecks. And I just did a quick in the moment research just now. End of 2022, Federal Reserve reporting 44 million Americans have student loan debt. That's about one in eight. Do I have that right? About one in eight. Let me make sure I've got the math on that. About one in seven Americans who have student loan debt. And the average federal student loan debt balance is $38,000.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that paired with potentially another round of interest rates coming up at the end of the year and all of this news about the pandemic era savings dwindling for Americans, it definitely, I think, causes some concern in the overall economic outlook going into next year.
Mm-hmm. This is supposed to be the fun segment.
I forgot this was supposed to be the fun. I thought it was the fun segment was at the beginning of the episode and Marcus was making fun of my outfit. I thought that was the fun part. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Rahul, save us.
Oh, geez, that's a lot of pressure.
What you got, mate?
This data comes courtesy of the CDC. So the U.S. marriage rate rebounded from a historic low of 5.1 per 1,000 people in the U.S., in 2020 to 6.0 per 1,000 people.
Getting married?
Getting married.
Okay.
I mean, that makes sense when you think about it in 2020. I mean, the sheer number of weddings that must have gotten canceled that year, I think the rebound is actually a little sad. But we're still nowhere close to the historical high. So the CDC has been tracking this data since, I guess, 1910. And also, why is the CDC tracking marriage data? What does that say about the way we conceptualize marriage in our society? Exactly. I didn't want to say it out loud, but
thanks,
Ross went there.
Spelling that, yeah.
I'm a happily married man. I just want to say in case my wife is listening. So the historical high, which is 16.4 weddings, marriages per 1,000 people, was recorded in 1946,
wow,
which coincidentally was the year after World War II ended, which again makes sense. There's a lot of pent-up demand if people were overseas serving the military and came back home, finally got to get hitched.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
It was hard to get married during the pandemic, even if you wanted to, though. Like, New York City Hall was probably one of the least efficiently operated places I've ever encountered in my life. They shut down four of the five boroughs. They didn't allow walk-ins, appointments at the time, because I was getting married at the time. Well, we tried to go through the city, and we had to use an outside facilitator. The appointments would, like, go live on the website at like 9 a.m. on Thursday, and it was harder than getting a COVID vaccine in the early days. Like, it'd be gone by like 9:01 if you hit refresh in your browser. So there was ineptitude by municipalities that made it hard to get marriage certificates during COVID, even if you wanted to.
Yeah.
And they were dealing with a lot of issues, so I guess they shouldn't be too hard on them, but it was unbelievable how poorly run it was.
Yeah. I wonder how much backlog there still is. People trying to get married, trying to book venues that were
I'd
already
hope it would
to
clear it out. I mean, that was almost 3 years ago.
Yeah. Ross, you're up, mate.
So this last weekend, the Miami Dolphins just absolutely destroyed the Denver Broncos. They put up 70 points on them. And it was the first time since the AFL-NFL merger in 1970 that a team had scored 70 points in a game. They were 2 points from the all-time NFL record, which was set in 1966 by Washington. And I wish they would have set the record because Miami had the ball with under 2 minutes and they could have scored. And they should have just kicked a field goal to rub it into Sean Payton's nose. They could have at least tried for a touchdown, if not a field goal. But they just let the clock run out because they already had 70 points. But it's one of the worst beatdowns in NFL history. They had over 350 yards rushing and passing, which has never been done. And their 726 yards of offense was just 9 yards shy of the all-time NFL record set by the 1951 Rams. So very rare, even in these, you know, the NFL right now is super pass heavy. It's never been more difficult to play defense than it is now. The league is artificially designed for offenses to thrive. Yeah. That's why passing records fall every year. Like, average run-of-the-mill quarterbacks are throwing for more yards than Dan Marino used to. Mm-hmm. However, given all that, we haven't seen 70 points and 700 yards of offense in 60 years.
Yeah, so. That was surprising. That both can be true, that it is much more of a pass-heavy, offense-friendly game now, but that record hasn't... We've not been close to breaking that record in quite a while. To anyone who played against Tua Tagovailoa, Raheem Mostert, or Tyreek Hill this week in fantasy, commiserations is all I'll say.
Yeah, they put up like half a season's numbers in one day.
They should have gone for it, though. I agree with you. All right, folks, I got one for you real quick. So I just came back from a wedding. One of the legs of the trip was only about 40 minutes on the plane. So I was wondering, what is the shortest commercial flight you can take? But we'll start with the very first flight that anyone was ever able to take, obviously talking about the Wright brothers. So according to NASA, after several unsuccessful attempts on December 17th, 1903 is when it happened, at Kill Devil, it's a terrible place to try to fly a plane, Kill Devil Hills near Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, poorly chosen location, Orville Wright completed the first powered flight of a heavier-than-air aircraft known as the Wright Flyer. Gents, any ideas how long it was in the air?
31 seconds. Also, is there something, does a not heavier-than-air airplane exist?
Yeah, that's a good point.
I don't know if you played Sonic the Hedgehog, but like, if you get in one of those bubbles, you'll float out in the air. So I think someone must have been in one of those bubbles.
31 seconds is too long. It's too generous. It lasted just 12 seconds.
Wow.
Traveled about 40 yards. That's also about 40 meters for metric people. Reached a top speed of 7 miles per hour. So you could have walked alongside it just as fast. This was the first of 4 flights that day. Their final flight of the day bested their first try, not difficult, by traveling nearly 3 American football fields or soccer fields in just under a minute, 59 seconds. And so, coincidentally, that is the same flight time as the shortest flight in the world today, which is a long-established air route between two of the Orkney Islands, Westray and Papa Westray, just above Scotland. The distance is less than 2 miles, and the actual flight is often less than a minute. By a boat, Scotland. What are we doing? Who's getting on this plane?
It sounds dangerous.
The boat?
The flight. It can't be like a large airplane for it to only like, it's like, what is this like rinky dink airplane that they're like flying over?
Let's have a look at what let's see what it looks like. Yeah, it looks very unstable. It's just one person at a time. I made that up. That would be cool though. You'd feel like you're in a private jet for a while. The longest non-stop flight.
No. For a very, very short period of time.
For less than a minute. The longest non-stop flight in the world is Singapore to New York's JFK. That covers 9,500 miles. So that's 15,000 kilometers. That's the longest non-stop flight in the world. Australian airline Qantas is currently testing flights known as Project Sunrise, linking Sydney with New York and also London, a route going to London, both covering upwards of 10,000 miles.
Do you happen to know how long the flight is, like the flight time from New York to Singapore?
Oh, good question. Let's have a look. In moment research. 18 hours and 40 minutes.
Brutal.
12 was enough. That's all we've got time for this episode. Thank you so much to my guests. Thank you to Blake.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you to Rahul.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you to Ross.
Thanks, Marcus.
And thank you to Victoria, who edits the show, James, who copy edits it, and Stuart, who runs the team. Thanks to everyone for listening in. You can find us on Instagram at Insider Intelligence, one word. We've moved. We're not podcast underscore behind the numbers, or I've forgotten what it was. I never knew what it was in the first place. But we thank God we've moved to a simpler place. We are now at Insider Intelligence, one word, for all the behind the scenes content you can possibly inhale. We'll see you guys tomorrow. Nope, we won't. It's a weekend. We'll see you Monday instead for the Behind the Numbers Daily, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Awin. Happy weekends.